Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2021, and you're listening to episode 231, which is a discussion about G.K. Chesterton's insights into the Book of Job. On this episode, I'm joined by Rebecca Valerius, who holds a Master of Arts in Cultural Apologetics from Houston Baptist University and a Bachelor's in Biochemistry from the University of Texas at Arlington. Rebecca has written a feature article, which is our cover story for the Volume 44, number one issue of the 2021 print edition of the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called G.K. Chesterton on the Book of Job, and you can read it when you subscribe to our magazine at equip.org. Rebecca, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here.
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, Rebecca has written our cover article for our most recent print edition, and it's on G.K. Chesterton and his thoughts about the Book of Job. But I don't know if all Christians really know who G.K. Chesterton, especially the younger generation of Christians, because he's not probably as well known as, say, someone like C.S. Lewis, who everyone seems to know. Just in general, they've heard his name. And it was interesting because there's a young family at my church and they have a whole bunch of kids. And well, he might be early 20s, maybe early 30s at the latest, probably 20s. And I wanted to know who his son was named after because I felt that Gilbert was a very old-fashioned name for someone. He's in his 20s. And he said, oh, my son's named after G.K. Chesterton. So that's how I know the G in G.K. Chesterton's name is Gilbert. So anyway, will you give us some background on G.K. Chesterton and, you know, who he was and, you know, what his contributions were to Christian apologetics and like some of his well-known works?
Yeah, sure. I love to talk about G.K. Chesterton. It's one of my favorite subjects under the sun. So he's probably best known today for being an important influence on C.S. Lewis. You mentioned Lewis. In fact, Lewis wrote in his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that Chesterton was a writer who he credited with baptizing his intellect when he read him as a young atheist, so before he became a Christian. He called Chesterton's Everlasting Man the best popular defense of the full Christian position he had ever read. So Chesterton taught Lewis, according to Lewis, that Christianity can be deeply intellectually satisfying. So today, most people do discover Chesterton through Lewis. So Chesterton was born in 1874, 24 years before Lewis, but he really came into the public radar in the early 1900s. With some of his commentaries on Victorian writers, like he wrote a great series on Charles Dickens, and also his first book, 1905, Heretics. So like Lewis, Chesterton also made the journey from unbelief to Christianity, and he traces the intellectual journey of this in his masterpiece of Christian apologetics, Orthodoxy, and that was written in 1908. But I would say that Chesterton was more than just an apologist. He was an incredibly prolific writer and journalist. He wrote many novels. One of them was The Man Who Was Thursday, a pretty famous one. He wrote lots of short stories, essays, detective fiction. He wrote the much-loved Father Brown series. He wrote plays, hundreds and hundreds of poems, and copious newspaper columns. So he was very prolific. And as an apologist, he participated in many public debates with famous people of the time. He even debated Bertrand Russell at one point. And I think, in my opinion, when reading Chesterton, I was immediately struck by this undercurrent of joy that just accompanies everything he wrote. He had this ability to just find the eternal value in the simplest, everyday, humdrum things and then take great joy in them. In fact, I think of him as an apologist for the goodness of existence itself. So C.S. Lewis noted that Chesterton made an immediate conquest of him as a writer and thinker, and I can certainly say the same. And I think it's this deep joy that one senses in his writing. It's, I think, the kind of joy that the Apostle Paul refers to in Philippians. Chesterton also seemed to have learned the secret of being content in any and all circumstances. So it's hard not to want to learn this from him. So I think that's one reason why he remains popular today.
And I do think that Christians today should discover some of his well-known works, including the one that you mentioned, Orthodoxy, because it really just lays out a defense of the Christian faith. And so I think that's an important contribution that he made to the work of apologetics in the 20th century. So this particular cover story that you wrote for us has to do with Chesterton's thoughts about the Book of Job. And so that's kind of an interesting topic. So why were you inspired to write an article particularly on Chesterton and his insights to the Book of Job in particular? Because normally when people talk about Chesterton's work, I don't think we think of, oh, what did G.K. Chesterton have to say about the Book of Job?
Yeah, so he wasn't a theologian. So yeah, so keeping in mind this irrepressible joy that just rings throughout all his writings, as I read him, I kept coming across references to Job. He refers to Job a lot and in a way that just revealed a deep admiration for it. I have some quotes here. He called Job an inexhaustible religious classic. He called it a masterpiece of the Jews that he compared to the pyramids of the ancient Egyptians. He wrote that centuries hence, the world will still be looking for the secret of Job, which is, in a sense, the secret of everything. He compares it to great works of antiquity. He writes here, the Iliad is only great because all of life is a battle. The Odyssey, because all of life is a journey. The Book of Job, because all of life is a riddle. And he even dedicated several essays entirely to the Book of Job. So this just astounded me because I find that Job has to be one of the least joyful books of the Bible. And so it's certainly one I've always struggled with. So to me, it's long, depressing, tedious. Job's friends in the middle part of the book just keep going on and on. They won't let up. They do these long speeches. And then there's a strange prologue that's hard to understand. And when God finally enters to speak, he doesn't answer Job's questions. God doesn't defend himself. He says some beautiful things about creation, but nothing really that I find comforting. But somehow Job is satisfied. So it's always been a mystery to me. And it was even more mysterious when I found out that Job was Chesterton's favorite book of the Bible. So to me, here was this Christian that embodied joy in his writing in a way I'd never seen before. And yet he loved the least joyful book of the Bible. I called him the apologist for the goodness of existence. Yet he loved the book of the Bible in which Job, the central character, curses the day he was born. So I had to find out more. I thought perhaps Chesterton had discovered the secret of Job just as he discovered the secret of joy.
Well, I want to know specifically where in his writing does he deal with the themes of the Book of Job?
Yeah. So an interesting fact, scholars have long noted that Chesterton's most popular novel, The Man Who Was Thursday, which is a bizarre sort of political fantasy. When you first read it, you think it's a political fantasy. They say that's probably, you know, more than likely a meditation on Job and Genesis. And then in two extended essays, he writes exclusively on Job. Leviathan and the Hook is the first one. And that's in his book, The Defense of Sanity. And then in another one is an introduction to Job, which was an introduction to an illustrated version printed in 1916. But like I said, in various other works like The Everlasting Man, I think even in Orthodoxy, Chesterton refers to Job a lot. So, and again, people have long observed that Job was his favorite book of the Bible.
So according to G.K. Chesterton, you know, you talked about his thought that Job was his favorite book of the Bible. What did he think about the book in particular as it related to other well-known works of antiquity, for example?
Yeah, so what makes Job stand out from all the other works, similar works in antiquity, is its unique views on justice, on cosmic justice. And this is where I was really delighted to find that Chesterton's insights are remarkably similar to Old Testament scholars, so theologians, many of whom see the book of Job as a direct challenge to the predominant ancient views of how the gods interacted with mankind. So scholars will tell you a key to understanding the book of Job is that it represents a commentary on all the ancient ways of understanding evil and suffering. In fact, it's an explicit rejection of other ancient theodicies. In my research, as I was writing this, I went to an Old Testament scholar, John Walton, up at Wheaton. He's written several very good books. He has the NIV commentary on Job and another smaller book at more of a popular level called How to Read Job. I highly recommend those books. He notes that each of Job's comforters, his friends, represents one way that the ancients tried to answer the problem of evil. And they, you could say, each represents an ancient philosophical explanation for suffering and evil. And even Job himself expresses a view I think that we all can have, namely that we expect an answer to why we're suffering in this life, that justice, in fact, demands we have an answer. And like Job, we kind of rather arrogantly assume that if we got the answer, we could actually understand it. So with respect to Job's friends, they clearly uphold what the scholars call the great symbiosis. And this was this idea that there was a sort of codependent relationship between man and the gods. And piety for the ancients centered on keeping these needy gods happy, mainly through some kind of ritualistic performance. And the key is that genuine righteousness really didn't matter. It was always just in one's best interest to serve the gods for prosperity would result. And suffering was a mark that you had offended them in some way. And so Chesterton notes this, as do the theologians, that this is what the challenger in the prologue asks when he challenges God. He says, "Does Job fear you for no reason?" In essence, he's challenging this great symbiosis. He's asking if righteousness is its own reward. And this was a question that was virtually unheard of in the ancient world. So the book of Job sets out to overturn this distorted ancient view on justice that essentially makes it relativistic and makes God kind of the author of evil inadvertently. And a key point in Job that Chesterton found was that God does not run the cosmos on his justice alone. I mean, obviously, if he did, who of us would survive? But by his wisdom.
I do want to note for some of our listeners, if they go to our website, equip.org, that we also have, you mentioned John Walton's work as to reference it, but there is some of his work that we are critical of with regard to origins. So if anyone wants to look up what that is, then they can go to our website, equip.org. We have some reviews of his books. You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Rebecca Valerius, who is discussing her cover article for the Volume 44, number one issue of the print magazine for the Christian Research Journal. And her article is called G.K. Chesterton on the Book of Job. And you can read it when you subscribe to our magazine for $33.50 at equip.org. So another way that you can support us besides subscribing to our magazine is simply tell a friend about this podcast, especially if you're a regular listener. We would like to have new people joining us all the time to listen to the content on this podcast. In addition, a really amazing way to help us would be to write a review for our podcast, specifically on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, but you can write a brief 1 or 2 sentence review or just give us a starred rating. And that's really easy to do, not much time. And another way that you can help us out is just to give us a thank you tip for all the content that you're getting for free on this podcast. You can do that at our website, equip.org. If you go to the magazine tab and the pull down menu, you can see Postmodern Realities. Click on that and you can find the link to give us a tip at any landing page for your favorite episode. And as a matter of fact, we're all the way up to 231. We started this podcast back 5 years ago, and we're getting to even 250 this year. So that's kind of exciting. And there is so much content here. So if you have missed anything, or for your new listener, please go back and look at our big library of past episodes that will be ways to encourage you and equip you in your faith. And thank you for listening. We were just talking a little bit more about the book of Job and G.K. Chesterton's insights on it, but I don't want to assume that every listener even is familiar with the story of Job before I dig in and ask you a few more questions specifically about some of the book itself. And so just to give a high overview for some of our listeners, Job is a book in the Old Testament, and it tells the story of a man who lived in a place called Uz, and he was, the Bible says, you know, blameless and upright, and he feared God, and he was very, very successful, very wealthy, had a big family. And in chapter one, Satan comes to God and says that he wants to test Job. And so God allows Satan to do so, and basically Job loses everything that he has. And so this is a book that really grapples with suffering and, you know, the justice of God and all of those kinds of very difficult, big questions. So I just wanted to say that in case people hadn't really dug into the, for themselves, into the book of Job. And, you know, I'm wondering what you think about Chesterton as he thought about Job. What parallels did he see in Job and, you know, Job's friends and for people today, although for today, you know, that back then, what did he see? He died almost 100 years ago. He died in 1936. But, and how does that kind of the parallels that he sees, what can we take away from that for, you know, contemporary Christians in the 21st century?
Yeah, this was one of the things that I so enjoyed reading Chesterton on this, is that he was able to make some parallels to today and to the modern times. So in essence, in the ancient views, as represented by Job's friends, the book of Job is basically saying, you know, your views of justice are just too simplistic. And if you read them and you take them at face value, they end in kind of a hopeless fatalism, because there's really no, righteousness is never really its own reward. God, even in fact, is not righteous. He's unpredictable, he's capricious, and we can't trust him. The key is that in this pagan view, then maintaining one's innocence in the face of suffering was ultimately futile. For the capricious gods could not care less about righteousness. They just wanted to be served. And so the pagans affirm that justice must be set aside and power must be appeased. So Chesterton notes that Job's friends affirm this view, and they apply it to God. And he writes that, quote, "For all they really believe is that God is not good, but that God is so strong that it is much more judicious to call him good." So here we have might makes right. But I think it's really important to see, and Chesterton notes this, how these great defenders of this sort of symbiotic relationship with God receive his harshest rebuke. He says, God says, "My anger burns against you," to Job's friends. He says, "For you have not spoken of me what is right." And Chesterton makes the insightful remark that this rebuke in Job may have saved the Jews from what he calls an enormous collapse and decay. And I have a quote here. He says, "For when once people have begun to believe that prosperity is the reward of virtue, their next calamity is obvious. If prosperity is regarded as the reward of virtue, it will be regarded as the symptom of virtue. Men will then leave off the heavy task of making good men successful, and they will adopt the easier task of making out successful men good." In other words, when we see someone that's successful by some worldly standards, we assume they're righteous in some way. They're being blessed by God. And even as Christians, we can fall into this. We tend to make out success as like kind of a sure ironclad proof of God's approval. Thus, you know, the proof of someone's righteousness or our own even. And we, unfortunately, we do this. I'd say we even do this in Christian ministry. Sometimes we measure success, righteousness by numbers and other outward worldly things alone, and then we forget the heart and how we treat others. And this, unfortunately, lends itself to this ends justify the means mentality that Chesterton is talking about, and which is very close to the advice given to Job by his friends. So in the end, we have to be humble when it comes to making pronouncements about particular instances of suffering, unjust suffering that we see. You know, of course, we all know that we are sinners, and the fall is the ultimate reason why there is suffering in this world. And we have to be humble and admit that we are often our own worst enemies when it comes to making the kinds of choices that lead to our own suffering. But when it comes to an individual suffering for what appears to be no reason, like that of Job, we are commanded to just grieve with those to grieve, and most of all, be humble. And I think this is so important as an apologist. You know, we know that God can have reasons for allowing particular instances of suffering. And this is what we call an apologetics, the solution to the so-called logical problem of evil. But we still have to be humble as to then claiming to know those reasons. And really, as Job shows us, we can even understand those reasons if we were told them. So ultimately, we just might not know. And in the end, we have to end up trusting in God's wisdom and how he laid the foundations of our world.
And that's one of the things about the book of Job itself that must be grappled with, because we see how God replied to Job towards the end of the book. And so how did G.K. Chesterton understand that reply by God to Job? And how did that help Chesterton, you know, deal with the problem of evil? Because that's kind of one of the big questions that hangs over this book in particular, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Because all of a sudden his things are taken away and his children are gone, and just this one thing after another, one calamity after another. He's has health problems, he's covered in sores and all kinds of things. And so it's like, and you know, I would say that in our modern sensibilities, whether we're Christians or not Christians in the West, we think there's an outcome towards what we do, right? If we, yes. if I do these things and I could be successful,
yeah.
then, you know, why would something bad be happening to me, quote unquote bad? And yeah. so sometimes that's just really hard to understand, especially when you look around at other people. I mean, even Job's wife tells Job, why don't you curse God? And so it's these big, you know, philosophical questions that people ask as they see suffering around them. So, you know, how did reading the book of Job and thinking through it help Chesterton in his own view of how to, you know, grapple with the problem of evil?
Yeah. So Chesterton, this is another thing that just fascinated me. He had such a different response to God's reply to Job than I had. So again, the book of Job tells us the problem of evil cannot be reduced to a simple equation. And for Chesterton, this is exactly what made existence so exquisite, that God does not rule the cosmos by his justice alone, but by his wisdom. And so when God enters, he sets and starts to speak to Job out of the whirlwind, he sets before Job a picture of ordering and not chaos. And I think this is key, because this was something very different from what the other ancients thought. God orders the cosmos and cares for it. He is not capricious with it. And he knows it's down to its tiniest detail. You know, he goes into some pretty specific details about different animals and different parts of his creation. And this is, of course, one of the most beautiful sections in the Bible, this poetic section when God is speaking about creation. But I think the key that we need to pull from this is that he is not one of the fickle gods of the other ancient theodicies, whose ways were inscrutable because they were ultimately chaotic. But God is telling Job, I know what I am doing. And I think for Chesterton, God also very vividly shows Job that the world is more fantastic, larger, and more complex than Job is accounting for. And in essence, he's making Job see that though there is suffering, it is not the entire story. Existence itself is still wonderful, even if it means a degree of suffering. And let me just quote Chesterton here. He says, "This, I say, is the first fact touching the speech, the fine inspiration by which God comes in at the end, not to answer riddles, but to propound them. Yet Job was comfortless before the speech of Jehovah and is comforted after it. He has been told nothing, but he feels the terrible and tingling atmosphere of something which is too good to be told. The refusal of God to explain his design is itself a burning hint of his design. The riddles of God are more satisfying than the solutions of man." And I think Chesterton would agree that all the, quote, solutions of man as presented in Job and in the world of philosophy and theology since its writing may explain, try to get pretty close to explaining why there's unjust suffering, but these explanations ultimately leave us cold, hopeless, and unsatisfied. And of course, the biggest riddle that's sort of the undercurrent in all of Job is Christ. As Christians, we can look back and see this. And this is something that Chesterton saw as well.
In your article, you write this specifically, quote, "Chesterton classed Job as one of the greatest poems ever composed, primarily because of its enigmatic ending," end quote. So even though the ending is a little bit of a riddle, he thought it was one of the greatest works he's ever read. So can you unpack for us why he thought that?
Yeah, so Chesterton noted that our natural human tendency, if we were to have composed this poem in our own earthly, finite strength and wisdom, I think we would all have God enter and answer Job's questions, because that's exactly what all the other ancient theodicies would do. We'd have God, in essence, come in and give lines and lines of tedious explanation for Job's suffering, not unlike Job's friends. And as unsatisfying as we may find God's answer now, I think we'd just be flat out annoyed at him if he had done this, like we're annoyed at Job's comforters. But the thing that Chesterton notes is God doesn't do this. He compels Job to look beyond his own suffering and see that there is much more going on in the world than just this evil that Job is experiencing. And in fact, it is a far more complex world than Job is allowing for. And such complexity cannot be governed by Job's limited view of justice. You know, he said, God directly challenges Job, you know, what would you do? Would you rule the world? Can you do this? You know, gird up your loins. And, you know, Job's limited view of justice is just not going to cut it. And then ultimately, we know that God does not rule the cosmos by his justice alone, but by his mercy and love. And all in all of this combined in his wisdom. And so I think this is what Chesterton means by this enigmatic ending of Job and why it's so much more satisfying.
So how do you see particularly that G.K. Chesterton's love of the Book of Job? You know, you said that one thing that you noted about his life, that it was very joyful. And so how would this interest in the Book of Job, which is not obviously a joyful book, contribute to his outlook on life to be joyful? I mean, how does Job inform his own apologetic that, you know, existing in life is a good thing? Because it, you know, like I mentioned earlier, even his wife said, Job's wife said, you know, why don't you curse God and die? So how would that bring, you know, these, it's kind of a downer of a book, most people would say. So how did Chesterton look at it completely differently and say, well, this, there's something joyful in this book?
Yeah. So we go from Job cursing the day he was born to Chesterton, who I think, you know, after reading and studying his life, you know, this realization that existence itself has given us something good, it was key to Chesterton coming to Christ. So Chesterton once wrote in response to the philosophers who said that it was the best of all possible worlds, that it would be much better for us to think that our world is the best of all impossible worlds. And this, you know, Chesterton's typical play on words that he loved to do, but there's a really deep meaning here, because I think it really does capture Chesterton's entire approach to life. And this best of all impossible worlds idea is kind of what God is telling to Job too. So Chesterton writes, I have a quote here. Job puts forth a note of interrogation. God answers with a note of exclamation. Instead of proving to Job that it is an explicable world, he insists that it is a much stranger world than Job ever thought it was. And so, in other words, the world would not be reduced to this oversimplified great symbiosis and oversimplified explanations for the problem of evil. And I think this is why Chesterton will say elsewhere, the best philosophy begins in humility and wonder. And of course, as the Bible tells us in multiple places, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom and joy.
So this is one of my favorite quotes that I didn't know about until this article. Chesterton has this quote, quote, "The refusal of God to explain his design is itself a burning hint of his design. The riddles of God are more satisfying than the solutions of man." I love that part. The riddles of God are more satisfying than the solutions of man. So what does he mean specifically by this?
Yeah. So when God refuses to answer Job, but he just kind of propounds the riddles, right? I think Chesterton saw that in essence, God is saying, unlike his friends, you know, Job, there is meaning to your suffering. Even if you can't understand it, I do. I am good. I am intimately involved in my creation, and you can trust me. And the really neat thing is that as for readers of Job, if we take along with Chesterton and the other Old Testament scholars, one of the purposes of the poem is kind of an object lesson as a commentary on all the ancient theodicies that ultimately made God out to be evil and the author of chaos. We know from our special reader's perspective that Job's suffering actually really does have profound meaning. It's teaching us something. Job's suffering is put forward again as an object lesson to teach us that even the righteous suffer, something completely unheard of in the ancient world where suffering was a mark of sin or a mark of offending the gods in some way. And so we know that through this divinely inspired great epic poem about Job and his suffering, God was actually preparing and preserving the Jewish nation and through them, eventually the world, preparing them for this concept that there would one day be a perfect man, and that most righteous man ever to exist will actually suffer the most. So Chesterton saw a direct connection, as many theologians do, between the suffering of Job. And he said, you know, this foundation was laid for this greatest of all riddles. He called it the high and strange paradox of the best man in the worst fortune, the best God-man, as we would understand Jesus. He said, and this is the heart of our gospel. And so Job, in effect, prepares the world for Jesus.
So you write at the beginning of your article this statement, quote, "Every cosmology is a theodicy or anti-theodicy. Every philosophy endeavors either to explain suffering or to explain it away." So can you unpack that? I mean, what about the book of Job makes it unique in this respect exactly?
Yeah, so this is something that I've just kind of realized as I've studied apologetics. You know, every cosmology, philosophy, or worldview contains in it, if you look at it, an attempt to explain the problem of evil and suffering, especially unjust suffering. Even if a philosophy ultimately tries to explain it away, like today we have materialistic naturalism, it tries to explain evil and suffering away by calling it ultimately an illusion. And, you know, this idea that thinks some things are evil really arose from our instinct to survive. It still is having to deal with it. So I kind of see evil as the elephant in the room of existence. It's the elephant in the room that every philosophy has to kind of deal with. So as a young agnostic, Chesterton noticed this too, and what ended up bothering him most was not the elephant in the room, the evil, but the room itself, existence itself. What was it about this room, about existence, that makes evil such a stark blight on it and forces us to have to deal with it? I have this quote here from him that really captures it. He says, "Our attitude towards existence, if we have suffered deprivation, must always be conditioned by the fact that deprivation implies that existence has given us something of immense value. We call it evil. We see the elephant in the room because the room itself is something better than that." So this realization led Chesterton to the conclusion that existence itself is good. This is why I call him the apologist for the goodness of existence, even if this means a degree of suffering. And so as an agnostic in his search for the philosophy that began from this starting point, he found that the Bible gave us the only worldview that said, as the book of Job said, there were shouts of joy, all the sons of God saying together, when God laid the foundations of the earth from, I think that's Job 38:4. And so how does Job completely bypass the theodicies that all these other philosophies attempt? Not by claiming that the answer to why there is evil and suffering is ultimately inscrutable or an illusion, not by giving an answer either, but like Chesterton, the book of Job also focuses on the room. God comes in and focuses on existence and creation and not the elephant in the room, the suffering. So God says, in essence, I hear him saying, the room with the elephant is far more complex than you can imagine, Job, and it is not run on my justice alone, but on my mercy and grace, and as well as my love. And so again, the Old Testament scholar John Walton puts it this way. He said, the role of the book of Job is to perform the radical surgery that separates theology from theodicy, contending that in the end, Yahweh's justice must be accepted on faith rather than worked out philosophically. He does not need to be defended. He wants to be trusted.
So in thinking about some of those themes, you know, what kind of parallels did Chesterton find between Christ and Job?
Yeah, so again, Job taught the ancient world, and it teaches us now that the righteous do suffer. I think naturally, just as the ancients, if we did not have this category, we would automatically just assume that some kind of suffering is some kind of punishment, direct punishment. We have failed to please God in some ways, always. You know, sometimes it is, God does discipline the ones he loves, but we're talking about unjust suffering here. So, but Chesterton saw Job directly as a foreshadowing of what he said, what he called the best man or God man, Jesus, in the worst fortune. And Job also teaches us that unjust suffering can be redeemed too. So it brings to mind Jesus's words, blessed are those who suffer for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of God. So again, there's this idea of suffering despite righteousness. So I think for Chesterton, he just saw the book of Job as another means by which God was preparing first Israel and then the world for a suffering savior.
So how can our listeners find out more about G.K. Chesterton? In other words, what are some of his works that you feel like that are must reads if they would like to actually read, you know, some of the ones that are maybe not just well known, but just kind of essential Chesterton? What is essential Chesterton?
Wow. So this is always a question. You know, I say it really depends on the person. Of course, I hope my article here inspires people to go read what Chesterton wrote on Job directly. And so that was in his introduction to the book of Job and Leviathan and the Hook. And both of these can be found online. Also, I say if you like detective fiction, it really doesn't get much better than his wonderful Father Brown series. There are several movie and TV adaptations out there, but they really pale in comparison to reading the stories themselves. And if you like Christian apologetics, I say Orthodoxy and The Everlasting Man are must reads. Again, The Everlasting Man was one of C.S. Lewis's favorites. It sort of gives you an outline of the Christian story. And then if you want something shorter, I would say begin with like a good compilation of his essays. There are a lot out there. One in particular is called In Defense of Sanity. And, you know, I would just add the wonderful thing about reading Chesterton is that almost all of his writing is in the public domain now. So you can get it all on the web. But I always give this note of caution. He was widely read in his day. He was very popular, but his prose is pretty cumbersome to us moderns because we tend to like to get to the point and get there quickly. And I have this quote here by Joseph Pierce, another Chesterton scholar, who says, that's not the way Chesterton works, but he says, Chesterton is more like his master, Aristotle. He is peripatetic. That is, he wanders from place to place in pursuit of what is to be found there, enjoying the walk with truth so much that he's not too concerned with how long it takes or how far it takes him. So I always tell people, Chesterton kind of forces us to savor the experience of getting to the point. He takes a while. And I would say sometimes I think the savoring might just actually be the point. Reading Chesterton is definitely like taking a journey. And another thing I always suggest is to grow accustomed to his style, it really does help to listen to an audio version as you read along, because he has pretty, you know, long, complex sentence structures, and it takes a while for us to get used to that today. And there are a lot of excellent audio versions out there. So, you know, just all in all, be patient as you read him and just allow him to take you on a journey. You won't regret it.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Rebecca. So, Rebecca, what's your favorite meal?
The thing that first thing that popped in my mind was salmon. I love salmon.
What is the last photo that you took on the camera roll on your smartphone?
Oh my goodness, I have no earthly idea. It was probably one of my daughter's homework assignments that I had to mail to a teacher.
Knowing what you know now in life, what advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
Lighten up.
Well, also, you're much older than your 18-year-old self, so if you didn't have to sleep, what would you do with the extra time?
Read.
Well, thanks, Rebecca, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you. It was fun.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Rebecca Valerius, who has written our cover feature article for the volume 44, number one print issue of the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called G.K. Chesterton on the Book of Job. And if you're a subscriber, you can read it in our magazine that you should have just recently received or are about to receive. Or if you'd like to read it and get this issue as the first issue of your subscription for $33.50, please go to our website, equip.org, and subscribe. Thank you. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comment section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.